Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, but who would want to listen to this?
Hey, what's up, girl? How you doing? Somebody's acknowledging you.
Hey, girl. I know my three daughters don't want to listen to that. I once took my 16-year-old to a basketball game, and the looks and gestures and whistles she got. I mean, let's just say I did not feel like a proud papa. I basically felt as though when I let her out of the house, I'm dropping her into a shark tank. And that's a really great feeling.
This is Mike from Eugene, Oregon. And I never catcalled women because when I was younger, I witnessed my sisters getting catcalled. And I vowed that I would never be that creepy.
Hey, Mike, I'm with you. We'll get into a deep conversation about all that later this hour. We'll talk about the wisdom from a high school soccer coach who has changed lives for the better for more than 40 years. Plus, political money drawn to AGs, attorneys general, hold a lot of power in states, and the parties suddenly want it. But first, this is not a joke, and last spring, John Oliver, host of HBO's Last Week Tonight, told his viewers this is no drill. It's time to let the FCC know about net neutrality.
The FCC are literally inviting internet comments at this address. And at this point, and I can't believe I'm about to do this, I would like to address the internet commenters out there directly. Good evening, monsters. This may be the moment you've spent your whole lives training for.
Lots of laughter there, but with Oliver's help, 3.7 million comments came into the FCC on the issue of net neutrality, calling for treating all internet traffic the same, no matter whether the customer is a giant media corporation or just a tiny little website. Internet service providers want to charge companies like Netflix and Hulu for the amount of bandwidth it takes to deliver their content. But last January, a federal appeals court struck down FCC rules that would have stopped them from playing favorites. Now the FCC is currently considering a proposal that would allow internet providers to charge content companies like Netflix to get their content to you faster. If someone can pay to get things faster online, then others are stuck with getting it slower or not at all. Michael Copps is a former FCC commissioner and a senior advisor for media and democracy reform at Common Cause, a liberal nonprofit advocacy group. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Does the apparent interest on the part of Americans commenting on the net neutrality issue in the FCC comment period give you hope that maybe their voices will be heard?
It gives me hope. I always realize, though, that we're up against very steep odds. Lots of money, lots of lobbyists, lots of lawyers on the other side. The power of the special interests in Washington is probably unparalleled since the Gilded Age of the 1880s and the 1890s. But I think when you get a real grassroots movement going, that can trump the power of the special interests. Doesn't happen very often, but that's where real reform comes from. And when we're talking about the future of the open internet, I think we're talking about the need for real reform to make sure that it does not become the playground of the few at the expense of the opportunity and well-being of the many.
The bad thing here, it seems to me, is the deregulation that took place in the 90s. If communications and the building of the broadband internet system had been more of a regulated system where the federal government was involved sort of in the same way it got involved late in the railroad game and early in the telephone game, we'd have less of an argument for private control because the private companies think that this infrastructure belongs to them.
Well, you'd have that, and you'd have a much more robust infrastructure to begin with. I think what these companies are doing now is rationing scarcity. It works fine for them. They're making big profits by rationing scarcity. We needed a national mission in this country, not just the late 1990s, but more recently in the last 15 years, too, to build this infrastructure. You cannot be a successful, productive member of society in the 21st century unless you have access to robust, high-speed, high-value, low-cost broadband with an open internet accompanying it.
Did the Clinton administration and the Senate under the Clinton administration make a mistake by not supporting that kind of federal investment to create a broadband infrastructure?
I think every administration has made a mistake doing that. I think the Clinton administration, certainly the Bush administration, they were ideologically opposed to it, plus the pressure of the special interests. But I think President Obama had an opportunity. And let's give him credit. He did more. At least they came with some broadband investment. But we needed much more than that kind of broadband investment. We were running the risk of not just the risk, but the reality of real digital gaps in the United States of America. We've got over 30 million households in this country that don't have any broadband connection, fixed or mobile.
Can the federal government fix those gaps and declare the existing infrastructure a common carrier and regulate its access and its bandwidth?
Right. But I don't want to fall into this trap of this is all about regulation. This is about seeing who is going to be in control of the consumer or the citizen's online experience. Is it going to be to the maximum extent possible that citizen and consumer, or is it going to be an ISP, a Comcast, an AT&T, or a Verizon? And that's the way we need to work at that. We should clear all of that underbrush away. This is simply about, is the FCC going to call advanced telecommunications, which is logical, which it should do, and treat it as such and have some light-touch public oversight of it? Make the assertion, reestablish the authority, then we can work with Internet service providers and the public interest groups and consumers and fashion the rules.
When Verizon says, this is our fiber optic infrastructure, are they a special interest in this particular case?
Of course they're a special interest, and they're a special interest that is aspiring right now to be not only a monopoly, but they want to be a totally unregulated monopoly. And I had thought, I used to be a historian, that we had kind of settled those debates at the beginning of the 20th century, and we weren't going to let these huge companies go without public interest oversight.
Would you support a federal tax incentive system or some set of incentives for these companies to reduce the scarcity, to increase the infrastructure, to increase the bandwidth that would incorporate all of the users equally?
I think they've got plenty of incentives right now. What held us back for a long time was just this ridiculous ideology of the Bush administration that the market was going to solve all of these problems and go and build broadband, even in areas where there was no business case to build broadband. But this is going to be investment on a much larger basis, and I understand it's difficult to do that, but you have to look at this as an investment in the future of our country.
When you visited the meetings, if this comes down on the side of the corporations, do you think the pitchforks come out? People take to the streets on this? Is this a real revolution brewing?
Well, it ought to be. We'll see. I mean, you have to have a media that covers it. You guys in public radio do the best job of that. I think media is starting to cover this because they see this grassroots starting to develop. It's hard to develop that kind of a grassroots movement. We're trying. 4 million people have contacted the FCC. I think that's a good beginning. And God knows we need reform in this country, and there's no place where we need it more in making sure that we have a communications infrastructure that serves the needs of the people, gets them the news and the information they need in order to make intelligent decisions for the future and practice the practical arts of self-government.
Michael Copps is former FCC commissioner and a senior advisor for media and democracy reform at Common Cause, a liberal nonprofit advocacy group. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
Hey there. You're looking nice. Doesn't that sound shocking coming from a public radio host? But it's basically street ambience when a woman goes out in public.
Hi, my name is Denise Painter, and I'm calling from Seneca, South Carolina. I was in college, and I was walking down the street with a friend of mine, and this carload of guys drives by and starts going, "Hey, baby, baby," and things like that. And it suddenly occurred to me how ridiculous this was, and I started flailing my arms in the air and running after the car kind of comically, going, "Wait, wait, come back. You're the man I've been looking for."
Brave Denise. Hope she wasn't taking her life into her hands. That's for sure. Claire is infuriated by this. She wrote us a epistle on Facebook. Street harassment and catcalling are pretty much a part of my daily existence as a woman. I absolutely detest being out in public because of it. I've been harassed after accidentally making eye contact, and I've been harassed when every single ounce of my body language is screaming, leave me alone. I'm told not all men are creepy, Claire adds, but countless women, myself included, are screaming that this is not a compliment, that it's absolutely terrifying.
Hi, my name is Maggie, and I'm calling from Miami, and women experience catcalling from all over the city, from suburbs to downtown. I've experienced it as young as 14, walking home from school with my friends.
Hi, Philomena from Westchester. Yes, street harassment. I unfortunately started to experience it when I was in grammar school, and to the point where actually police had to come to my parents' house once, but many times growing up, and it's not a pleasant experience. And some people think that a guy cackling at you is a compliment, but I think a pleasant comment can be a compliment, not that kind of cackling.
Hi, this is Katie calling from Garnet Valley. I think myself and all my friends have been catcalled at least once, have been yelled at, whistled at. I think the real problem is that it's a shame because women are told to take it easy, chill out, take it as a compliment. But I don't think it's meant to be taken as a compliment. I think it's about a sense of entitlement that these guys think that their opinions need to be heard and that they should be heard.
Well, this is a job for GoPro. We'll talk more about all this later with Emily May, the co-founder and executive director of Hollaback, the group behind a GoPro video that's begun an important conversation here. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Here's a story of some local politics that may talk a lot about some national trends. A really hot race in the state of Illinois is the race between incumbent Lisa Madigan, who's the attorney general, and her opponent.
Lisa Madigan has taken on the most powerful special interest in this country on behalf of the people. She's gone after the pharmaceutical companies for price gouging, cracked down on for-profit colleges and abuses in student lending, and she's holding Wall Street accountable for mortgage fraud.
The banks will never be able to do enough to clean up the mess that they caused in our country.
Lisa Madigan has recovered over $15 billion for the state and the people of Illinois. Lisa Madigan, she never stops fighting for us.
Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan there says she is fighting for the people, but with millions of outside dollars flooding into this race and other attorney general races around the country, it's hard not to wonder how state AGs are really acting on behalf of the people. Is it possible that these power centers could become political centers as well? Joining me now is Eric Lipton, investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times. Welcome, Eric.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's just begin in New York for a moment. I mean, it really, the attorney general position in New York became a stepping stone to the governorship quite a while ago. But now it seems like this trend has gone nationwide.
Yeah, definitely. Attorney generals are seen as future senators, future governors, and it is seen as a training ground for both the Democratic and Republican Party. And the party organizations look at it that way, and the corporations look at it that way. And that's why, in part, they're funding the campaigns of attorney generals, even if they, you know, just for future purposes.
As you follow the money, what are you seeing around the country?
Well, there's no question that in the last five or so years, really perhaps even a decade, that the corporations have taken a much greater interest in the role of the attorney general. There's, you know, more than $10 million that have gone to an organization this year named the Republican Attorney General's Association. Money from the energy industry that was trying to beat back regulatory agenda from the Obama administration, for example, relative to coal burning plants, and from pharmaceutical companies, from food companies, from internet providers. So the corporate world has seized the attorney generals as a potential serious threat, and so they want to fund them and build relationships with them.
I would think that an attorney general who looks really cozy with a lot of special interests, unlike maybe some other politicians, that would really derail her credibility with the electorate.
I mean, they're sort of, you know, pushed in both ways. You know, like that advertisement that you had, Lisa Madigan is celebrating the awards that she's won that have brought revenue to her states and that have, you know, penalized companies for actions that, you know, considered inappropriate. But at the same time, they've got to raise a great deal of money to get elected. And they also, you know, many of them are thinking about running for other offices. So there's a balancing act, and there's certainly pressure on them to not alienate this community that is a major source of funds.
So the trend here is to really make attorneys general a lot more like members of Congress who really have to fight for money and chase money almost from the moment they get elected.
It's happening mostly through two organizations, the Democratic Attorney General's Association and the Republican Attorney General's Association, which they're set up so that, for example, if you contribute $125,000 to RAGA, as they're called, you get special access to the Republican Attorney Generals. You get to spend the weekend with them at a resort near San Diego where you go sailing, you go to a baseball game, you have dinners and drinks with them, and you just have time to build a relationship with them. And the strategy on the part of the corporations and the lobbyists is if you can build a kind of personal relationship with the Attorney Generals, they're less likely to demagogue you and less likely to sue you, and perhaps they would call you and talk to you about something they see as a problem before they initiated an investigation.
And going on these retreats is not a violation of ethics rules on the part of the AGs?
No. I mean, for example, Pam Bondi, the Republican Attorney General from Florida, went to the beach villas at the Dell, which is part of the Hotel of Coronado. And she flew there, her hotel room, her food, you know, her entertainment, more than $6,000 she spent over essentially a long weekend. That was paid for through corporate sponsorships of the corporations, the Sands, the Las Vegas Sands, Comcast, Altria. They were some of the corporations that were present at this sort of resort weekend that she went to, and they paid the bills basically indirectly through RAGA.
Has Citizens United changed the dynamic here or accelerated any trends that we've already seen?
It's another example of this: the large amounts of money from corporate America and also to some extent from unions that are going into the political process. There are even fewer limits on state contributions. In many states, you can write a $25,000 check directly to a candidate. In Nebraska, in Missouri, there are no limits on the amount that you can contribute directly. So it's not even Citizens United. It's just that, in fact, in many states, there are even fewer restrictions than there are on federal candidates.
It used to be the case that all attorneys general ran on tough on crime agendas. It seems like that's broadened as people have gotten more interested in these races.
Many of them, and there's no question, as you ask the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they'll tell you, I mean, the attorney generals continue to be extremely aggressive. They've collected tens of billions of dollars from financial services companies in the recent years after the recession and actions that were taken that perhaps caused the recession. They've gone after pharmaceutical companies. They've been very aggressive, and that's the reason that the lobbying and the money from the corporate side has increased so much, because they see these attorney generals as a serious threat. So, you know, both sides are essentially pushing hard, and it just, but there aren't the rules and regulations that exist around Congress or around many state legislatures. They don't really exist around attorney generals because it has not been a traditional arena for lobbying.
Eric Lipton, investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
On the soccer field at Martin Luther King Jr. High School, it's another performance that doesn't quite measure up.
Come on, go! Go to the ball! You're waiting for it!
And that means another lecture from soccer coach Martin Jacobson at Riverside Park Field in New York City.
Bad day, good day, bad day, good day. No more bad days allowed. You can't miss goals in the front. You just can't. That's it. That's your last bad day if you want to win this cup.
Does a coach like this sound familiar? Nationally ranked coach Martin Jacobson, who leads one of the winningest programs in the nation, joins me now as part of our week-long look at high school sports. Coach, welcome.
Thank you.
So is there a line between tough encouragement and sort of soft, smushy kind of support in coaching? I mean, you really have to crack the whip sometimes, right?
Absolutely. The student athlete has to feel, or the player has to feel, that you really care about them. That's essential in all of coaching. However, you need to do a little tough love every now and then and hold them accountable for anything that's unacceptable and praise them for acceptable behavior.
And do kids go along with this? Do they resist this sort of thing? Have you seen a change over the years?
You know, I've been coaching 44 years. What can I tell you? I feel like I'm John Wooden all over again here. I see them going totally liking guidance and direction. They need that in their lives, especially the kids I have are New York City's finest players and they're from immigrants. A lot of born here now, but they're, you know, first generation. And a lot of these kids' parents will say, "This is the, now he's yours. You guide him." And you know, I don't know how much you know about our program, but you know, I've got 96% graduation rate. I've got kids going. 11 pros played for us. I've got hundreds in colleges. So I just encourage them to be work hard in school and work your dream out.
So what speech would you have given last night at the World Series?
What speech would I have given to who? The winner or the loser?
Yeah, I know. It's a tough choice. It was a pretty close game. How do you keep the Kansas City Royals from wanting to jump off a bridge?
I would probably jump off the bridge with them because I, yep. You know, so let's just say that has to take time. I'll give an example. We're the winningest high school team in the history of New York, but back in 2005, you know, God forbid it'll happen again, I think someone had to take my shoelaces away. You know, we lost the city championship in a semifinal. I mean, we actually lost that year in the semifinals. And interestingly enough, today we play in the quarterfinal. So to say, hang in there, it'll get better. Time heals all wounds is the old cliche. I like to win. It would be a very tough speech to give.
Now, personally, you weren't always a winner, were you?
And as I tell the kids, it's how you end the game. You know, I had a tough setback in my life, and it was about 30 years ago, and I was, you know, I was addicted to heroin, and I recovered. One in a thousand make it, and it was a struggle, and I was homeless and penniless when I arrived back in New York, being born here, raised here, and it gives hope that anybody can, you know, encourages people. Maybe I hope through my story that you know you can get better and you can heal and you can go forward.
Did sports turn that around? What was it that turned it around for you?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. To have a passion reemerged in you is something that can heal you, can take you away from your demons. And that is what happened. I was able to reinvent my passion for coaching. I mean, I was still playing a little bit, and I played until I was, you know, 55. But, you know, I'm not sure if I'm helping the kids or they're helping me, but I think that's what it's been all along. You need that athletics. The athletics is such a healer. It's such a way to motivate and change and go forward in life, especially if you face the, like I say, the demons or the bad part of your life.
How did a coach put your demons away, and how does your life tell the story of the kind of impact a coach can have on a kid, even when the coach maybe isn't completely aware of it?
You know, I would say the coach, through his example, any coach through an example of being positive and a great role model, can change and direct kids' lives in such a positive, positive way. The cursing, screaming coach doesn't work. The coach that disciplines does work. The coach that shows they really care about the kids and the kids' future, that works. You know, all these and life experiences of an experienced coach, a good coach, will take his life experiences and give it to these young athletes that we deal with. And I deal with adolescent boys. You know, I deal with, you know, high school boys. I've been a high school coach for all these years. So I call myself a schoolboy coach.
When you lost your dad, did your soccer coach replace him in some way in terms of guidance, somebody to look up to, somebody to hold on to?
Well, basically, since I started the game at a young age, I was, they called me a troubled youth, actually. Mischievous, I would say, vandalism and shoplifting and things that could have led to another direction. And at an early age, I was, instead of the police, they took me to the recreation center, local recreation center on Long Island, which I was growing up at that time. And I met a wonderful man named who was a Holocaust survivor who grew up in Brazil, migrated from Germany to Brazil. And actually, I recently just reconnected with him. And he was an All-American at Cortland State. And anyway, similar to how I coach now, because I don't have goalposts or a field to coach on, he took us around in these little fields and put cones down, called it a soccer field back in the 1950s. And, you know, he emerged, he brought that passion into me. He introduced me to sport. And then from then on out, not to say I didn't get in trouble later at my younger ages, obviously I had a past, but at least at an early age, I finished school and I went to college and played, and I played in a kind of a semi-pro situation. And so an influence, a chance encounter or an encounter of a person who cares can help your life for sure and change your direction that you're going in. And hopefully that's what I'm doing with these kids now.
Well, go MLK.
Go MLK.
All right. Good luck, Coach.
Thank you so much.
He's a legend and a rascal. Martin Jake Jacobson is the varsity soccer coach at Martin Luther King High School. His team is undefeated, and we'll find out in early November if they've made it to the Nationals. We've been hearing some sports stories from you all this week. New Brunswick, New Jersey, I had a private wrestling coach who was an ex-convict. His early life experiences and his complete lack of any type of self-censorship really made him a unique influence. Although most parents wouldn't have let kids my age in the same room with him, it showed me that people are worthy of second, or in his case, third chances. He was and continues to be a huge influence on my life.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Learning to live with all that unwanted sexual attention. Boys will be boys, right? And then when you get infuriated enough, learning how to find a way to live without it. It's an unfortunate part of growing up as a woman in America, and whether it bothers you or not, it's there. I mean, who gave these guys permission to shout out to Sarah?
Sarah from Oklahoma. It is pretty much impossible to count the number of times I've experienced street harassment, but while I was in college, I was outside of my house before a football game, and a van full of guys drove by. One of them leaned out the window as they passed and yelled, "Hey, how much to suck my d-?" I got pretty angry and ended up running down the street after their vehicle, screaming at them to get out and say that to my face. They didn't. And I ended up feeling both violated and helpless, but satisfied that I had at least expressed my frustration rather than kept silent.
Hi, this is Vanessa from Miami, Florida, and I have dealt with some street harassment and catcalling. It never really bothers me unless the person is being vulgar or using obscene gestures. I don't see anything wrong with someone saying things like, "Hey, beautiful," or "You're looking fine today." When that happens, I just smile and say thank you and continue on my way. I ignore the negative and appreciate the compliments.
But hey, guys, you want to see what this looks like from a GoPro camera? No. It's not as pretty as your righteous BMX bike moves or snowboarding moves.
How are you doing today?
Smile.
That's not good.
Smile.
What's up, beautiful? Have a good day.
Hey, what's up, girl? How you doing? Somebody's acknowledging you. Hey, beautiful.
Hey, beautiful.
How
you doing?
You doing good?
Hey, look at that.
That is the sound of a very, very arresting video produced by Hollaback, a New York City-based organization that fights street harassment. Emily May is the co-founder and executive director of Hollaback. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was the methodology here? I mean, it's part anthropology and it's part technology. How did you go about really casting the net wide to try to get as many incidents as you possibly could?
Yeah, this video was created by Rob Bliss, who approached us with the idea because he was fed up with his girlfriend getting harassed all the time. And we were like, yeah, I think this is a great idea. And our idea was that if we could have this message out there and show people what it looked like and what it felt like to be harassed, that they would have some empathy and start to understand the way that it impacts women's lives.
And so you posted this. And how much time did the actress spend on the street?
She was on the street for 10 hours. And in those 10 hours, she was harassed 108 times. And she went through, you know, mostly Midtown. She went through, you know, lower Manhattan, upper Manhattan, but, you know, really tried to stay in high density her areas, because what we've seen after mapping street harassment for the past, oh, I don't know, 5 years now, is that we've seen, you know, it mostly occurs in high density areas.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response?
I mean, the response has been incredible. I think, you know, the loudest response is just women coming forward and saying, thank you for showing the world what this looks like and what my world feels like.
Now, the editing process, you had to make some choices here, and it looks statistically from the video that it's a lot of African Americans who end up, you know, doing the catcalling. When you look at everybody who was in the unedited version, is it a pretty uniform distribution?
Yeah, what we know about street harassment is that it happens to all different kinds of folks in different ways, and that perpetrators are across socioeconomic lines. This video shows one woman's experiences of street harassment, and while it's an accurate portrayal of what she experienced in those 10 hours, it's not necessarily going to be an accurate portrayal of what everyone experiences as they walk down the street. And what we want, you know, folks to know is that if you really want to hear the real story about street harassment, ask the women in your lives.
Hmm. And what did you see that crossed the line from rude and vulgar to maybe something threatening and a loss of safety?
Yeah, you know, I think that street harassment is really defined by the people who are experiencing it. That being said, I think that street harassment really ruins it for the nice guys. Look, we all want to live in a world where people can say, good morning, how are you? You look amazing today to us as we walk down the street. I think that's just neighborly conduct. But in a world where street harassment is so prevalent, where good morning so often, in my own experience, escalates to something much, much more lewd, that can't exist. And so I think if we want to, you know, create a world with respect, we need to start by stopping street harassment.
In our sexualized pop culture and advertising content, does it invite this kind of behavior, or is there no excuse for it? Should people understand the lines no matter what their background is?
You know, I think, sure, the hypersexualization of women in the media is a big piece of this. The biggest piece of this is sexism. Sexism is alive and well in America as much as we want to pretend like we've moved past it. And, you know, the street harassment that Shoshana faces, and also the—
Shoshana's the actress.
Shoshana is the woman in the video,
who was really upset by doing this. I mean, she really had a hard time at the end of the 10 hours.
Yeah, no, it incredibly hard, you know, and now she's getting a series of rape threats and violent threats. And, you know, and I think that just speaks to the fact that, A, this video has hit a nerve, and B, we've got a long way to go as women in this country.
Well, online, nobody catcalls. It's, you know, rape and death threats that is the nomenclature online more regularly. That's another disturbing phenomenon. We could talk for 10 minutes about that. Let me give you some male comments that we've received and that perhaps you've received. Rich from Philadelphia: my brother took a woman by the arm one time to holler at her. I wasn't sure at the time if I was completely appalled or incredibly impressed by his bravado. Florida: I'm a man, and I've said, hey, beautiful, to a beautiful woman before. Wasn't trying to be abrasive, just saying, hey, beautiful, to an attractive woman. I've been called, hey, handsome, or gorgeous, or sweetie by women I've never met before and didn't take offense to it. While I'm sure being an attractive male gets nowhere near as much attention as being female, I don't understand how someone hitting on you is oppressive. Some of the comments made to the women in the video were out of line, but some just seemed normal to me. What's your response to that?
Here's the thing. It's a little different walking down the street as a woman as it is walking down the street as a man. When we hear comments like that, you know, we never know when something's going to escalate into something more severe. And you see in this actual video, a comment that sounded relatively benign actually escalated into the man stalking her for 5 straight minutes, following her right beside her as she silently walked for 5 minutes. And that's not uncommon. You know, these things do escalate, and they can escalate into things like stalking or groping, you know, and even sexual assault. And so as a woman, we're always sort of braced and ready that one comment is going to become so, so much worse. And that's the difference. That's the difference. The streets aren't the same. And I think that men live in a different universe a lot of times when it comes to walking down the street than women.
Here's a challenge. In 15 seconds, what's going to change this?
We're going to show people that get harassed that they're not alone and that we've got their back.
What about men? What do you have to show men? You have to show men something that's going to constrain them.
And we're going to show people that don't harass that this is a really serious issue. We want to show people what this looks like, what this feels like, and we want them to stop. Well, we want a national outcry.
Certainly done that. Emily May, co-founder and executive director of Hollaback, the group behind this video all about catcalling and harassment on the street. We've been hearing from you this hour about your personal stories from Washington. When I was young, I never felt beautiful, but people said I was, and I got that kind of attention all the time. I was of two minds about it. It was flattering in a very uncomfortable way, but it was also disturbing. From New York City, I own a construction company, and I have fired guys for doing this. Thanks so much for listening, and keep your stories coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.